Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was all public hugs and hand-holding this weekend in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, as the tough-talking president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, made his first-ever presidential visit to the Saudi kingdom. No big agreements, but a tension-easing show of neighborliness between the big oil power and the big rising power in a region screaming with tension. With Iraq on fire, Iran talking nuclear, and its old ally, the U.S., in trouble, Saudi Arabia, the Islamic Holy Land and the world's oil basin, is in high gear these days, pushing Washington, calling in chits, praying it does not face a region-wide unraveling in the Middle East. Up next on Point, princes, zealots, oil billions, and Saudi Arabia's agenda now. Joining me first today from Burlington, Vermont, is Gregory Gauz. He's professor and director of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of Vermont, considered one of the country's top Saudi watchers. Professor Gauz, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What has got Saudi Arabia on the march on so many fronts right now, whether it's the meeting they had in Mecca trying to get the Palestinian factions together, or they're reaching into Lebanon? They're obviously staring at Iraq and staring at Iran with its nuclear ambitions now. How do you read the big motivators behind Saudi Arabia right now?
I think like most international political initiatives, this one's motivated mostly by fear. The Saudis, at the end of 2006, I think we're very worried that the United States might be pulling out of Iraq. And we're facing on their border a chaotic Iraq, Iran resurgent in the region, and very worried about the balance of power consequences of that. And so you see Saudi diplomacy really pick up supporting the Senura government in Lebanon against Hezbollah.
Hezbollah, backed by Iran, of course.
And, of course, as you said, trying to mediate the Palestinian differences, not so much to advance an Arab-Israeli peace process, but to try to wean Hamas, which had been supported by Iran, away from Iran, try to get intra-Palestinian unity and cut Iranian influence out of the Palestinian community.
In the lifetime of the royals governing Saudi Arabia, has this region ever looked in worse shape? And that's saying a lot, because we've got the Gulf War in there. We've had years of Israeli-Palestinian problems. There was the Iraq-Iran War. But have things ever looked worse than they do right now for the Saudi royals?
I think if you're sitting in the palaces in Riyadh, life looked a lot worse in August of 1990 when Saddam Hussein had taken over Kuwait and was knocking at your door.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that things are good now.
On the other hand, let me just ask. I mean, yeah. Then you had the U.S. and the world ready to come to your aid in what was a pretty much largely uncontroversial block to Saddam right then, whereas now the future looks much vaguer, one could imagine.
I think that's true. It wasn't uncontroversial in the Middle East, but there was a lot more world support for defending Saudi Arabia at that time. I think that the thing that the Saudis have going for them now is that oil prices are relatively high, and they've got a lot of money to spend. That helps quiet things down at home. It also increases their leverage abroad. The other thing I think they have going for them is that I think the Iranians ultimately could overplay their hand in the region. This is an extremely difficult region to corral, as we in the United States are finding out, unfortunately. We have a lot more resources than the Iranians, and we can't do it. Now, that doesn't mean that the Iranians aren't a threat to the United States, but the Saudis, I think, are playing the Iranians in a relatively sophisticated way. They see them as a threat. They're trying to roll back their influence on the margins, but they're also they don't want a direct confrontation. They're dealing with them directly.
Professor Gauz, if you could stand by for just a moment, I want to get the latest on that meeting over the weekend in Saudi Arabia when Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, of course, Iran, the enormous Shiite country in the region, visited Saudi Arabia, the kingdom, the
center of Sunni life in the region. We're joined right now from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, by Hassan Fatah, reporter for The New York Times. He covered the unprecedented weekend visit there by the Iranian president, Ahmadinejad's first as president to Saudi Arabia. Hassan Fatah, thanks very much for being with us. How do you read the outcome of this very unusual meeting in Saudi Arabia?
Thanks for having me. I think in many ways it was more of a public diplomacy type of event. It was meant to be seen and it was meant to send a message to much of the region as well as to the West. Certainly the Saudis wanted to be seen negotiating with the Iranians as well as trying to calm things down. There had been a sense here in the region over the past several months of an escalating confrontation and a seeming spiral towards something much worse.
Much worse. What is it that the Saudis fear?
I think ultimately the Saudis fear open conflict, which would hurt everybody in the region.
Open conflict with Iran?
Certainly not necessarily themselves having open conflict with Iran, but the blowback of the conflict itself. You've got two aircraft carrier floating around the Persian Gulf right now.
U.S. Carriers, yes.
And you do have an escalated military presence and growing tensions that have been escalating significantly, really.
So in terms of public diplomacy, what did the Saudis gain from being seen, the king there, holding hands in the Middle Eastern style with the Iranian president? And what does Ahmadinejad himself have to gain from, you know, smiling and talking nice with the Saudis rather than talking big and tough?
Well, in many ways, I think Ahmadinejad benefits the most in this. And he sends out a message that he's willing to talk to the Gulf countries. He's not going to let it get to the wire, and he's not going to let it get out of hand, that he has open lines of communication. That was an important statement that he was making in his very public embrace of the king and being seen and that sort of thing. The Saudis, at the same time, also show that they're going to do what the Americans are not willing to do, which is to talk to the Iranians, and also open lines of communication to them. In many ways, this was a lot of people in the region, I think, breathed a sigh of relief over the past several days.
But the confrontation lines are still there on many fronts. Iran and Saudi Arabia competing for influence with the Palestinians, very openly competing in Lebanon. You've got the Shia-Sunni conflict in Iraq, and Saudi Arabia indicating that if Iran goes nuclear, I mean, not saying this formally, but back channel, don't count us on us staying non-nuclear. Were any of these, do we know if any of these were directly addressed? Were there new agreements? Is there some new starting point here, or just smiles, Hassan Fatah?
Well, that was the hard part. I mean, they effectively walked away with nothing concrete, either in terms of agreements, anything signed. But they both promised that they intend to reduce and curb the tensions between the Shiites and the Sunnis in the region, which is something that both sides have been growing very alarmed about, as well as to try to begin tackling the issue with the Palestinians, with Iraq, and especially with Lebanon, in which both have significant sway.
Remind us of the Saudi fear within its borders. It has a Shiite population of its own that is really centered in its most oil-rich area.
Indeed. The Shiites of Saudi Arabia are in the eastern province, which is where all of the oil in Saudi Arabia is found, and have been restive in the past. The Iranians have also not failed to remind many Arab countries many Gulf countries, that they too would be affected by any kind of American attack.
And Hassan Fatah, just to get us on the diplomatic calendar here, we've got an Arab League meeting coming up and also this meeting where Iraq will sit down with its neighbors, including Syria, including Saudi Arabia, including Iran, and the U.S. at that table. What's the timeline for these meetings?
Let's see. You've got the Iraq meeting that's coming up in the next, I think it was on the 10th, and then you've also got the Arab League summit meeting here in Riyadh in 2 weeks. So you've got this whole whirlwind of diplomatic activity that hasn't been happening for a long time, and in many ways that sort of livened up the situation. It's kind of let people breathe a bit. The problem is that, in fact, nothing yet is concrete, and there's nothing really to show for it.
Hassan Fatah with the New York Times in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Hassan, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Gregory Gauz, okay, here's a meeting with the president of Iran. What's your sense of Saudi confidence that they can keep a lid on the roiling tensions they've been facing on so many fronts?
Well, there's clearly no positive indication out of this summit that there's going to be some big diplomatic deal. But that's not what I expected. If Iran and Saudi Arabia agree on things, they're not going to announce it publicly. And I think that the first place that we'll see whether this summit has any concrete results on the ground is Lebanon. There, it seems to me that the Iranians might be looking for a way to help their client in Lebanon, Hezbollah, climb down from this confrontation it's entered into with the Lebanese government.
Why should they do that? They had such a claimed victory in the confrontation with the Israelis last summer. They seem to have Sinjora back on his heels. Why should Hezbollah climb down? Why would Iran want it to?
Well, I think that Hezbollah is pushing for a veto in the Lebanese government, something that its parliamentary representation doesn't accord it. This is tied up with the Syrian relationship because the Syrians are trying to avoid having an international tribunal that would look into the assassination of Rafiq al-Hariri, the former Lebanese prime minister, and a number of other Lebanese politicians. There's widespread suspicion that the Syrian government was involved in those killings. Syria and Hezbollah are closely tied. Syria is pushing for Hezbollah to have a veto in the government, so Hezbollah can, in fact, veto the Lebanese government's cooperation with the international tribunal. That's the way it's all connected. It seems to me, though, that Hezbollah is very possibly overplaying its hand in Lebanon. It can't govern Lebanon by itself. It can't overthrow the Lebanese government, given the demographic and regional realities in Lebanon.
Gregory Gause has joined us from Burlington, Vermont, at the University of Vermont there, and one of the nation's leading Saudi observers. Right now, Constantine is calling from Moline, Illinois. Hi, Constantine. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom and guests. I just want to make a quick point.
Yes.
I used to box, and before we used to go at each other, the referee used to call us together and knock gloves and terms basically shake hands, which is what's happening in Saudi Arabia right now, I believe. The two enemies, they shake hands, they knock heads a little bit, and then they go back to their corners and they try and beat each other up, which is, I think, what is going to happen. And the battlefield, the ring, is Iraq, and the United States went in. If they kill each other, they won't touch us in the long run. So I think it plays right into the United States' hands.
If they kill each other, they won't touch us? You're saying, okay, Iran, Saudi Arabia, knock gloves and go to it? Do you really mean that?
Well, everything is covert in life. Especially in the military, especially in politics and big business, big oil, big everything. So if your enemies go at each other, you know, when 9/11 happened, you know, America saw on the screens who did it, and, you know, they strategize in the war rooms, and I think it's exactly what the United States wants.
Constantine, we've got the perspective. Thank you for your call. Gregory Gause, let me bring in one more voice here. As we look at that, Bruce Rydell joins us from Washington. He's a senior fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Spent 8 years on the National Security Council under Presidents George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush. He was deputy chief of the CIA's Persian Gulf Task Force in the 1990s, early 90s. Bruce Rydell, thanks for being with us.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Let's just pick up Constantine's point there. Our caller from Moline, Illinois, says it doesn't look to him like sweetness and light. It looks like knocking gloves before a boxing match, A. And B, he says he's for it. Let them duke it out. Maybe that's the American way out of this. How do you respond?
Well, I think his point about boxing is probably a good one. I don't think that there's a great deal of love lost between King Abdullah and the Iranian leadership. That said, it is very consistent with what the king has done for years to see if he can develop a relationship with the Iranians. After the Khobar Towers attack in 1995, for example, the Saudis again reached out to the Iranians and saw if they could find a way to calm the situation in the Persian Gulf. And I agree with you completely. From their perspective, they are seeing some of their worst nightmares come true. An Iraq that may fall apart, may not even be an Iraqi state in a few months, even a few years. In Iran, which very much wants to fill that power vacuum and which seems to be riding a crest of victories in Lebanon and elsewhere. And an America which looks increasingly like it wants a way out of the Persian Gulf. The Saudis are well aware of the polls in the United States that show an overwhelming majority of Americans want to get out of this war. What the Saudis are afraid about there is that the U.S. is going to leave the mess that it created, that's their view, and then not help to try to fix that mess. I don't think it is in our interests for Iran and Saudi Arabia to go to conflict with each other. I think it's in our interest if we can find a way to calm tensions in the region. And I suspect that the administration is quietly supporting Saudi efforts to try to bring about a greater degree of regional calm.
Gregory Gause, we see what's happened with the Shia and Sunni in Iraq. We've heard the fear of that age-old conflict flaming up and spreading across the region. Do you see a possibility that that sectarian conflict in Iraq could inexorably draw Saudi Arabia and Iran into conflict, whether cooler heads in those countries want to be drawn into that conflict or not?
It's certainly a possibility, and particularly in the scenario that Bruce Riedel set out of an American withdrawal. I personally don't think the Saudis have many cards to play in Iraq. I think that they've been extremely cautious about trying to establish points of influence in Iraq for a couple of reasons. First, they don't want to get crosswise of the United States there. Mm-hmm. Second, who are they going to support? They would probably be supporting Sunni politicians and Sunni movements. But many of those Sunni insurgents are in league with the al-Qaeda types who are trying to bring down the Saudi monarchy itself. Mm. So the Saudis have real blowback problems there. I think that the Saudis are trying to roll back Iranian influence at the margins, Lebanon, Palestinians, but to try to do it in a way that doesn't lead to a direct confrontation with Tehran.
Bruce Riedel, let me ask you about the Saudis' interplay right now with the Bush administration. We saw this much-noted Dick Cheney quick trip to Saudi Arabia over Thanksgiving last November. Then lots of talk about Washington's policy, the administration's policy, perhaps changing in response to Saudi unease, to say the least. Prince Bandar, who had been the ambassador to the U.S., out after 20-plus years. Turki al-Faisal, the prince, in there and then gone within 15 months. What is the byplay here between Saudi Arabia and the U.S.? How is the Saudi voice getting its, I don't know, sorry to mix the metaphors, but getting, is there a hand on the steering wheel of the U.S. now from Riyadh, from the Saudi monarchy?
The Saudis have been very uneasy about this administration almost from the day it came into office in 2001. The Saudis thought they were getting a replay of Bush the father, that is, an administration which would focus very much on the Arab-Israeli conflict and be very sympathetic to Saudi interests. Instead, they got an administration which has downplayed the Arab-Israeli conflict, largely ignored it for most of 6 years, and which instead chose to go to war in Iraq. The Saudis have had a very tense feeling about that from the beginning. Now, at the same time, they also realize that America is the only superpower, and America has been the guarantor of Saudi security since the end of the Second World War. So they're in a tough bind. They aren't completely happy with a lot of things that the Bush administration has done, but they need to guide it in a direction they want it to go. And I think that's what they're trying to do now. They're trying to push Washington in a certain direction, which includes more attention to the Arab-Israeli conflict. And there we saw Secretary Rice's trip to the region last month in order to talk about a diplomatic horizon for an Israeli-Palestinian agreement, try to push the Americans into negotiations and talks with the Iranians and with the Syrians, following, in fact, the Saudi example. But the Saudis have another problem from the standpoint of the royal family, which is America is deeply unpopular in the kingdom today. Polls in the kingdom show that America's favorability ratings are at an all-time low and that 3 out of 4 Saudis have an unfavorable rating of the United States. Mm. So it's a delicate balance they have to play there.
Let me take a call from Montauk, New York. Tony, you're on the air.
Hello. Yeah. Thank you for mentioning that about how the Saudi people are feeling about Americans in general. You mentioned the Shiites in Saudi Arabia. Before, mm-hmm. but you failed to mention that most of Saudi Arabia, as I understand, is mostly Sunni.
Absolutely,
and that they support the Sunnis in Iraq. So the people that are supposed to be our friends, which are the Saudis, which also were the people that had most of the suicide bombers on those planes were Saudis. I believe it was 18. Is that correct?
15.
Yep.
And how the United States, its influence with Saudi Arabia, how we protected the Saudis and got them out of the country during during that period.
But you're suggesting, Tony, that the Saudis, because it's predominantly Sunni, maybe supporting a population giving the U.S. Mission in Iraq trouble. And let us look at that, if we may. Get Gregory Gause, how about it? When you say Sunni, there's many wings on that. There's a general population of Sunnis. There's the extremist population of Sunnis, a la al-Qaeda. But what about the Saudi interaction with the Sunnis in Iraq and how that factors into the American troubles there, if that's the right way of looking at it?
I do think we have to distinguish between Saudi government and private elements in Saudi Arabia. There's plenty of evidence that there's a support in Saudi Arabia for the Sunni insurgency in Iraq, financial support from private sources. There are Saudis who go up usually through Syria into Iraq. They seem to be overrepresented among the suicide bombers in Iraq, although the absolute number of Saudis and the absolute number of foreign fighters in Iraq tends to be exaggerated. We have no evidence, at least I've never seen any evidence, that the Saudi government is supporting Sunni insurgents. It wouldn't be in their interest to do so because, A, it would get them crosswise of the U.S., and as Bruce Rydell said, the Saudis still look to America as their ultimate security guarantor, and B, the Saudis since 2003 have experienced their own domestic fight against al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda wannabes in Saudi Arabia who are blowing things up. And so it would be against their interest to support the growth of that movement right across their border. But undoubtedly, there's public opinion support in circles in Saudi Arabia for the Sunni insurgency.
But Bruce Rydell, didn't the Saudis explicitly warn the United States that if they let Iraq descend into sectarian conflict, that they, the Saudis, would support the Sunni population there?
Well, they didn't do it explicitly. They did it with one step removed, which is they had a op-ed published in the Washington Post by someone who works for them saying that they would intervene. But here I think I would agree with what Professor Goss said earlier. The Saudis really don't have all that many cards in Iraq. They're not going to send the Saudi army across the border in order to defend the Sunnis. The Saudi army is barely capable of defending the kingdom. It doesn't have the capability of projecting force. And to send more money, arms, and suicide bombers to help the Sunni insurgency in Iraq could really be a blowback for them. Let's keep in mind the cutting edge of the Sunni insurgency in Iraq is now the al-Qaeda organization in Iraq, and that al-Qaeda organization has similar objectives to Osama bin Laden's larger al-Qaeda organization, and target number one on their list is to get rid of the House of Saud.
But how do they draw a line between supporting al-Qaeda in Iraq and supporting the Sunni population in Iraq, which is culturally close to their own and certainly as Sunnis close to their own?
It's a very difficult one for them to proceed with. There are lots of Saudi private individuals who are probably quite willing to support al-Qaeda in Iraq because they see what it's doing as highly successful, and they probably have some sympathy for al-Qaeda more broadly. The government, on the other hand, doesn't want to see al-Qaeda get any stronger and, in fact, wants to see it defeated. So they may be working with Sunni political leaders and some tribal leaders, but those forces seem to be the forces of the past in Iraq today, not the forces of the future and not the ones which are driving events there.
Of course, it leaves open then the question of that private, when you say private influence or private steps taken in Saudi Arabia, some of those individuals can be extremely wealthy. They can have quite a lot of material resources at their hands.
Absolutely. You're talking about people with millions of dollars and who have shown in the past quite a willingness to put their money behind their political views. You're also talking about influential figures in the Saudi Islamic clerical establishment, the Wahhabi ulama that has been the partner of the House of Saud in running the kingdom for the last more than two centuries. A lot of figures in the clerical establishment are also very sympathetic to the insurgency going on in Iraq and have been pretty open and public about their sympathy for it. So when you talk about how the look comes from being inside the palace, it's a pretty complex picture out there. And it's hard to see how the kingdom is going to be able to proceed through these shoals effectively.
I want to turn back to Saudi Arabia for a moment, to Jeddah and Khalid Al-Mayna. He's editor-in-chief of Arab News. It's an English-language daily newspaper in Saudi Arabia. Khalid Al-Mayna, thanks very much for being with us here again.
Thank you.
Let me just ask you first about how Saudis, ordinary Saudis, are looking at the region these days. What's the fear factor? What's the concern factor? How high?
Well, I mean, we are very much concerned. I mean, I was very much appalled at the level of knowledge that I heard just seconds before. People, the experts are talking about Sunnis and Shias, and it's way off the mark.
In what dimension? In what dimension, Khalid?
In dimension about, you know, the people, the support, the way, you know, how Saudis or some Saudis are going to help the so-called insurgency, quote-unquote. I mean, what's happening in Iraq is not an insurgency from Sunnis or anyone. The word Sunni and Shia is just derived recently. I mean, nobody would know in Iraq who's a Shia and Sunni. All these components have come up after the attack on Iraq.
Now, well, there's a lot of history there, too. What about the meeting with the president of Iran over the weekend? Has it calmed fears in Saudi Arabia?
It was a great meeting. Everybody in the region welcomed him. I don't know the experts across the Atlantic, what do they think of it? But everyone I spoke to in Qatar and Oman and Bahrain, we carried out a mini survey that they were very happy that these two neighbors, despite the differences, are putting their heads together. We don't want any mischief makers from outside to come and throw bombs, because whatever happens, we have to live together. We're just half an hour's flying time from Iran. There are 70 million on the other side. There are people here. We do not look at through a Shia or Sunni mirror. We are looking at a joint mirror because we are very worried about what's happening in Iraq. We are very worried what's happening in Palestine.
And what about in Washington, Khalid, and the Saudi relations right now with the Bush administration, Prince Bandar, Dick Cheney? How do you see that relationship?
Well, I mean, the problem, and this is the fault of the a lot of our people, is because they look at relations on a personal level. I think we have to look at relations with the United States vis-a-vis a nation level, vis-a-vis a regional level. We should try to define our relationship with the United States and see to it that we both work together. As I've always said before, I mean, our relations with the United States should be at par. We want friends and not masters.
Friends and not masters, but is this a relationship where goals are lined up right now? Do the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have the same goals in the region?
Not necessarily. I don't think so. I mean, they may have goals based on a personal level, but I think our goal is here at this moment to see that there's no war, and nobody in the Gulf wants an attack on Iran, God forbid, because it will really create chaos and mayhem, not in this part of the world, but I think in the whole world. What we want is that the United States play a major role as an honest broker in resolving the Middle East crisis. We would like to be partners with the United States and the whole Arab world.
Khalid Al-Mayna, thanks very much for being with us here again.
Thank you.
Professor Gregory Goss is with us from the University of Vermont, big Saudi watcher, and Bruce Rydell at the Brookings Institution. He was deputy chief of the CIA's Persian Gulf Task Force in the 1990s. Gregory Goss, what about the view we just heard from Jeddah, that this is all overblown, you know, don't make so much of this Shia-Sunni conflict, this is jingoism? What do you hear in that voice?
Well, I think Khalid Al-Mayna represents what in our terms would be a relatively liberal but relatively thin elite in the region that really does want to downplay those kinds of historic differences and sees them as irrelevant for the future of his country and his region. And that's certainly a point of view that we should encourage in the region. Mm. Unfortunately, when things come to crisis in the region, people tend to go to their corners. We talked about boxing at the beginning of the mm-hmm. show. And in a crisis, people tend to go to their corners. And unfortunately for the region, those corners tend to be sectarian in many places. And Iraq is, I think, just the latest proof of that. We could have had other people on from Riyadh, clerics. Bruce Rydell mentioned people in the Wahhabi clerical establishment who just recently have given fatwas that condemned Shia in very, very negative terms. Mm. So Khaled Amaina represents a point of view that I hope advances in the region, but I'm afraid it's not a majority right now.
Let me take a call from Boston. Ellen, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Good morning, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I wanted to raise an elephant in the living room. I assume that you've read the Cy Hirsch essay in The New Yorker.
Yes.
And this feeds directly into your program this morning. It appears that, according to Hirsch, the Bush administration is using unappropriated funds from the American taxpayer, as well as funneling some money through Saudi Arabia. I apologize. Don't have the article in front of me, so I can't quote you chapter and verse. But these monies are going directly to Sunni jihadist groups in Lebanon with ties to al-Qaeda. Now, Cy Hirsch does not claim that the Bush administration is directly funding al-Qaeda, but I'm sure Mr. Cheney is knowledgeable about the ties that these groups have. After all, we created al-Qaeda decades ago when we were fighting the Soviets, and so it seems that we're playing the same game now with possible very dangerous consequences to Saudi itself, because the rulers, after all, are not the people, who are very anxious about the United States, and very dangerous blowback consequences for us, who, after all, were attacked by al-Qaeda on 9/11.
Right. Ellen, let us look at exactly that. Of course, looking back there to the U.S. and Saudi role in mounting opposition to the Soviets in Afghanistan years ago, the blowback there coming in al-Qaeda's flowering years later. Now Seymour Hirsch writing in The New Yorker an article titled The Redirection, about some very sort of dark back channels alleged here now. Bruce Rydell, what do you make of it? The Saudis getting some tough Sunnis into play to counter the Hezbollah influence in Lebanon, at least. Can you explain what's going on here from your view, Bruce?
Yes, there's a battle going on in Lebanon over the hearts and minds of the Sunni community. The Saudis have been supporting the Sonora government. They've been trying to prop it up.
As has the U.S.
As has the U.S. Radical Sunni groups in Lebanon have, by and large, been more sympathetic to Hezbollah, however. And I think the Saudis see that as a danger to them over the long run and as a weakness of the Sonora government. I don't know whether the allegations that Cy Hirsch has put out in his article are true or not. I can't speak to whether the U.S. government is doing that. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if the Saudis are trying to rally as many Sunnis behind the Sonora government as they can, and even dealing with some which might be borderline sympathetic to al-Qaeda. The Iranians, for their part, are trying to get those people to come over to Hezbollah's point of view. Because at the end of the day, one of the problems that the Saudis face here is that Hezbollah and groups like it, which have stood up to Israel, are extremely popular throughout the region. Even in the kingdom, Hezbollah has gotten a lot of support since its relative success in the war against Israel last year in Lebanon. So the Saudis face a situation in which there's a great deal of popular sympathy for anyone who shows that they can stand up and fight Israel, and anyone who can stand up and fight the United States. They want to calm those tensions and try to bring people back from the brink of conflict. And that's why you see this energetic diplomacy today.
Is there some sense, Gregory Gause, that the Saudis tried to or did lay down the law with the U.S. late last year, saying, look, the bigger threat here in the Saudi view is Iran, even bigger than the Sunni extremist threat. Let's target the same enemy, White House.
I don't think anybody had to persuade this White House that Iran was a big threat. It seems to me that they've been concentrating on Iran for some time. If anything, I think at the end of last year, the Saudis were worried not that the U.S. was going to be less than confrontational with Iran. I think that the Saudis were worried that the U.S. was going to pull out of Iraq. And I think that was their big fear. And I saw the Cheney visit as part of an effort to reassure the Saudis and certainly to coordinate with them on trying to roll back Iranian influence in Lebanon and in the Palestinian community. But I think that the Saudis are actually less confrontational toward Iran than the Bush administration is. I think the Saudis, as I said, are playing a very sophisticated game of both trying to keep the Iranians close because they don't want a direct confrontation. They're going to be the ones who suffer the Iranian counterblows if we strike Iran. But at the same time, they want to try to contain Iranian influence. And I think that the Saudis are equally worried about Iranian influence and equally worried about the consequences of a direct American military strike on Iran. They want to go the middle way.
Let's take a call from Ames, Iowa. Kevin, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
My question is, do you think that the Saudi government can afford to risk weakening their coalition with the Wahhabi clerics by making up to the Shiite Iranian government?
It's a good question. Goes right to the heart of the Saudi kind of power arrangement. Bruce Riedel, what do you say?
It's a very delicate balance that the king has to pursue here. He knows that a good deal of his population is very nervous about the prospect of conflict between the United States and Iran. I think we've heard that from your guest in Jeddah. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, there are lots of Sunnis in the kingdom, which are very angry at what they see as a Shia war against their fellow Sunnis in Iraq. So he has to play a very delicate balancing game here to try to keep all of these players at least satisfied that the kingdom is seeking to pursue and protect the interests of the Sunni community throughout the region.
What about the American talk of democracy, rolling democracy across this region not so long ago from George Bush as a justification in part for the Iraq war? Did the Saudi monarchy ever take that seriously, and how do you think they look at it now?
I don't think they took that very seriously at all. I think they may have had a few worries in the beginning about this rhetoric, but I think they pretty quickly came to the conclusion that the Bush administration wasn't really serious about pursuing a program of sponsoring democracy throughout the region. And in fact, good polling indicates that very few Arabs ever took that seriously. They thought it was a cynical attempt to justify the war in Iraq to the American people on a new basis once there were no weapons of mass destruction to be found in Iraq. And I think the Saudis have come to the conclusion the United States isn't going to push that, at least inside the kingdom at this time.
So, Gregory Goss, here we've got this meeting coming up in just a few days now, March 10th, Iraq and its neighbors and the U.S. So there will be Syria, there will be Iran, there will be Saudi Arabia. Americans desperately looking for a way to patch things up in Iraq and maybe get out of there. Do you see hope in the kind of meeting we saw this weekend between the Saudis and the Iranian leader, with the Saudis pushing for more diplomatic effort here? Is there a hope that that the neighbors could somehow calm the waters, bring peace back to Iraq, put their own swords down, stop rattling the sabers, and, you know, could they have scared themselves collectively into a situation where they now could muster the wherewithal to bring peace or some kind of calm in this region?
Short answer, no. It seems to me that the fact that the United States is going to attend this meeting is a lot more tactical than strategic. You'll note that just this week, or at the end of last week, the Iraqi cabinet accepted an oil law that the United States had been pushing for quite a while.
Kind of dividing the spoils between Sunni, Shia, Kurd areas.
Exactly. And giving more of that oil revenue to the central government than had originally been anticipated, which is what the U.S. was pushing for. I think the quid pro quo for that is we're us coming to these meetings, frankly, because this initiative is for this regional meeting is an initiative by the Iraqi foreign minister, who in fact is a Kurd. And it seems to me that there's a lot of quid pro quo there. So let's not get too excited about that. Let's also not get too excited about the regional players being able to settle down Iraq, quote unquote. Bruce Riedel said earlier that he didn't think the Saudis had many cards to play in Iraq. I don't think the Syrians have many cards to play in Iraq. The only player in this game, frankly, that has a lot of cards to play in Iraq, I think, is Iran. And Iran is in a very advantageous situation in Iraq right now. Its people, its allies control the government. I don't think that the Iranians are going to reduce their influence in Iraq. And I don't think there's much that Syria or Saudi Arabia or, frankly, anybody else could do outside Iraq right now to settle down the insurgency. There are things on the margins without a doubt. But I think that there's an internal dynamic in Iraq now that has to work itself out.
So that describes a kind of ascendancy of Iran, which you don't see as slowing with all the changes for the status quo that may entail. Let's get a call from Buffalo, New York. Frank, you're on the air.
Yes. My question is, when everything is said and done, all these meetings have been accomplished and everything, is it possible that the Islamic unity that is found in the Quran will basically be taken serious and the peace will prevail throughout the region based on Islamic unity instead of sectarian Islam?
So get over the Shia-Sunni conflict after all these centuries and build the Ummah, the big harmony. Gregory Gause?
When Catholics and Protestants get together, that'll happen.
Bruce Rydell?
I'm afraid I have to agree. I don't see Islamic unity solving all of these problems. What I see is Iran becoming increasingly the dominant power in a more and more Persian Gulf. Geography, demography, and time are on Iran's side in Iran, as Professor Goss laid out. And I think the irony of President Bush's war in Iraq is that it will end with a much stronger Iran, dominant player in Iraq, and our interests in the region having been dealt a pretty severe setback.
I agree with Bruce in the short term, but I actually think that the Iranians have a lot of obstacles in front of them to play a real hegemonic role in the region. I think that eventually Iraq settles down and an Iraqi government, whatever Iraqi government is there, will try to assert its own interests vis-a-vis Iran. I also think that there's a natural balancing process that occurs in the region, and as Iran gets more powerful, more countries are going to kind of coalesce against it. Without a doubt, Iran is the biggest regional beneficiary of the Iraq war. But in the long term, I have doubts that the Iranians can actually play the hegemon. If we can't play the hegemon, how can they?
Well, they're closer to home. But anyway, let's get one more call from Berlin, Connecticut. Raul, you're on the air.
Hello, panel. I want to ask a question. You'll recall back in 2002, when Dick Cheney went around the region, he went around for a very specific purpose, which is to let the allies in on the fact that, in spite of all the hemming and hawing, in fact, the U.S. was quite sure it was going to go to war. Mm. And what he wanted to do was to make sure that the various airports and so forth were available to it from
right.
Saudi Arabia and so forth. And my question to you and to your panel is, do they think it's possible that Dick Cheney was actually doing the same thing? After all, Iran has flouted the UN sort of
Security Council mandate.
Security Council mandates, and we have all of these aircraft carriers lined up. Would it be possible that his trip had very little to do with Iraq and was really setting up with Australia and with Pakistan and with Saudi Arabia?
Let's go maybe to war. Raul, our time is short. Bruce Rydell, you've sat on the National Security Council. What do you say to that question?
Well, I certainly don't rule out that possibility. It would be consistent with perhaps the Saudis inviting Ahmadinejad to Riyadh this weekend in order to warn them that the United States is very serious and will take military action if the Iranians don't back off from their nuclear program. That said, I think the administration has also been very clear in saying that the United States is not planning on going to war with Iran at this time, and I certainly hope that is what the administration's real bottom line is, because I think an American war with Iran at this time would be a strategic disaster for this country.
Of course, at this time is not 5 minutes from now, and then who knows what. Gregory Gause, our time is short. We've just got a minute. Look out 10, 20 years in this time of flux. Do you see the Saudi monarchy surviving this period of upheaval in the region?
I do. They've survived a lot of upheavals before, whether it be the Pan-Arabist period of the 50s and 60s and the pressures on them then. They survived the Iranian Revolution. I actually think that if the Saudi monarchy falls, it's going to be from internal divisions and problems and the collapse of an oil economy more than external threats.
Bruce Rydell?
I fully agree. I think the House of Saud will be here 25 years from now. Their long-term problem is what to do when the oil age comes to an end, but that problem is not one they have to worry about today.
They've got plenty on their plates right now. You've both been great in painting this picture, filling it in for us, and we're grateful to each of you. Bruce Riedel at the Savant Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Mr. Riedel, thanks very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And Gregory Goss, professor and director of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of Vermont, author of Oil Monarchies. Gregory Goss, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.